Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Hi, everybody. Welcome to The Week, and welcome to All of It on WNYC. I'm Allison Stewart. Thank you so much for joining us today. Let's talk kids and oysters. Stay with me. The New York City school system is the largest in the country. According to the Department of Education, in 2017, there were more than a million students and 1,843 schools. There are schools with all sorts of specialties, music, dance, science, and one in particular just might save New York Harbor. The Urban Assembly of New York Harbor School has taken on the ambitious task of restoring the New York Harbor with the goal of seeding 1 billion oysters in the harbor. The school is the subject of a new documentary, Take Back the Harbor, directed by Emmy Award-winning filmmakers Christy Jacobson and Roger Ross Williams. Roger Ross Williams. I'm sorry, Roger.
It's okay.
The film airs Tuesday, December 18th at 8 p.m. on Discovery. Thanks for being in the studio.
Thanks for having us.
Yeah, thanks for having us.
So, Roger, we're going to talk about the issue first and then the school so people can understand what these kids are into and what they're all about. So when we're talking about New York Harbor, what boundaries are we talking about?
We're talking about the surrounding, not the, just the water surrounding Manhattan, but all the way up to the Bronx, all the way up to the Bronx and all the way over through Brooklyn.
Through to Queens and Jamaica Bay. So it's a really big body of water. So all the bridges that connect Manhattan are through, it's a lot of water.
It's all the water surrounding Manhattan. So let's talk about how polluted is New York Harbor?
It is pretty polluted. So if it rains a quarter of an inch, all of the sewage and all of the drains in all of the city goes directly into the harbor. So the harbor is basically filled with sewage. It's filled with refuse from the city. It is a mess. So it's a pretty, pretty filthy harbor.
Is our sewer system designed actually that way? What's up with the design of the sewers?
I mean, that's actually one of the most surprising things we learned, and we're longtime New Yorkers, is that there's something called the combined sewage overflow. That's what Roger was describing. And the system is set up so that it cannot handle more than an inch of rain. So it's a very old, outdated system. And there are many, many cities across the country that have the same issue. So the good news is, though, that, from the late 1970s when the Clean Water Act was passed, things have gotten better. So as bad as it is, it's actually better than it was.
Oh, that's amazing to think about.
You look at the overflow where it flows out and you watch the sludge of all of the poop in the city flowing out into the harbor, it's pretty disgusting to think that the water, it's going directly there.
And this is New York City.
Yeah. I may change my habits based on this documentary. Tell people about what happens when it rains and people use the loo.
Yeah. So when it rains, as little as a quarter of an inch, the system kicks in and everything that is coming out through our shower drains, our toilet pipes, the sewers that we see on the street, come out into like hundreds. There are hundreds of openings that go into New York's harbor. You see in the film, it's appalling when you look at it. So there is one thing that you can do, which is you can not flush as frequently as is possible, not shower, not do those things when it's raining. So that's one small thing that we as New Yorkers can do.
And also not litter. So all the litter and trash that people throw on the street that ends up in the gutter, that ends up going down the drain, ends up going into the rivers.
It's amazing to me. I've lived in New York for 30 years, and I'm from the area. I think there's more litter now than there has been in recent years.
That's kind of heartbreaking.
I mean, I walk a dog now, so I'm looking at the ground a lot.
Right.
I'm a new dog.
You know, one of the things that Pete Malinowski, one of the founders of the Billion Oyster Project, told us was specifically there are dog poop bags. That's dog poop. It's still poop. And the bags are obviously plastic in most cases. So, on the flip side, these students are like, you know, give me such hope. And mm-hmm. so, you know, maybe people our age or older are stupidly and ignorantly littering. But it seems like younger kids are not. And that's inspiring.
They're much more conscious. I mean, what's amazing is that these are kids who grew up in the Bronx and in Brooklyn. And, you know, what they said to us, when they see their parents throw something out of the car, one of the kids told me his parents threw like some McDonald's out of the car window. And he was like, stop the car and we're going to clean that up. That's amazing.
Wow.
That they are policing their own mm-hmm. parents.
Mm-hmm. That's excellent. We're talking to Roger Ross Williams and Christy Jacobson about their new documentary, Take Back the Harbor, which is going to be on Discovery Tuesday, December 18th. So this school, how did you first hear about this school?
Actually, Discovery approached me. John Hoffman at Discovery approached me, and he had read an article about it. And he's like, the Harbor School is this sort of amazing thing in New York that it's on Governor's Island. And it's a school where that teaches kids marine biology and teaches kids about the environment. And in New York City, we are surrounded by water and surrounded by nature, but we don't have a connection to it. And this school is sort of raising a new generation of kids that actually are connecting with the harbor around them.
As a filmmaker, Christy, why did this sing to you?
I mean, for so many reasons. I mean, first of all, the surprise of when you think about a school that's breeding the next generation of environmentalists, you don't imagine it would be in New York City. You think, oh, it might be in some town out in Colorado or in Oregon or something like that.
Someplace crunchier.
Yeah, exactly, exactly. And also, it was just this opportunity to kind of look at, you know, it as it turns out, you know, these past few years have been a moment when kids have really been elevating their voices and growing, you know, their activism is becoming, you know, what's I think going to be essential in saving the country and the planet. Mm-hmm. And so having like a front row seat and filming with these kids was something that we thought would be extraordinary. And you only need to take one ferry ride, get off on Governor's Island, meet 1 to 3 kids at the school. I mean, it's weird to call them kids, so young adults for sure, mm-hmm. To realize there's a story there. For Roger and I, we've known each other for decades, it was a great opportunity to, you know, come together professionally.
Yeah, and what was surprising to me is that, you know, is that these kids are kids of color. These are Latino kids and Black kids who are environmentalists and who are getting in touch with the city that they live in. And it's amazing to see, because you don't really think about environmentalists, as Christy said, coming from the inner city.
So is it a public school, first of all?
It is a public school.
And do you have to apply to it? Do you have to have certain grades? How do you get into this school?
So the public school system in New York is one in which you apply to high schools. But this school, and I don't know if this is true of other schools, I know it's true of this school, there are no grade requirements. You simply need to want to go there and mm-hmm. put it on your list. And so it really brings together kids from all 5 boroughs, from a range of socioeconomic backgrounds, and it's a really special place. Sadly, a unique place mm-hmm. in both New York City schools and in schools across the country.
And they travel; these kids often travel hour and a half to get there. And the beautiful thing is that they have to take the ferry every day to get to school. So just getting there is crossing the harbor and being in touch with nature and seeing the beauty of the city just arriving to school.
And also crossing the water to Governor's Island. It has meaning in their lives. They're saving this body of water that they travel across.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Several times a day. We're talking to Christy Jacobson and Roger Ross Williams about their film Take Back the Harbor. Okay, so how did the students become involved with the Billion Oyster Project? And what is the Billion Oyster Project?
So the Billion Oyster Project, as you mentioned, its aim is to replenish the once plentiful New York Harbor with 1 billion oysters by 2035. And the reason they want to do that is because oysters filter the water. They are a natural filter. And they also, as they grow, they create reefs, and the reefs create, you know, bring further underwater life. So New York's harbor was once bountiful. not what it looks like today. And so the goal is to bring it back to that once bountiful state. So Pete Malinowski and Marie Fisher, who are Pete Murray to us, came together.
Like Brangelina, right?
Exactly. Hashtag Pete Murray. They founded this organization, but key to it is the students of the Harbor School. So there is effectively the Billion Oyster Project and there is the Harbor School, but they are one and the same. Perhaps not technically, but these kids are learning these incredibly important skills that they are then actually applying on the ground or the water, as the case is, and physically placing these oysters. So one of the things we filmed was a giant reef being placed in Jamaica Bay, and this is this required big giant.
Barges.
Ships, barges. Thank you. I've lost my lingo. Barges, but it also required a lot of labor. And the kids are just so actively involved in this mission. And the Billion Oyster Project also partners with restaurants across the city who donate, and this is a really important piece of it, they donate their oyster shells from their customers, which again is really important. That reef that we saw being built was part oyster shell, part clamshell, and also part porcelain toilets.
That is a funny pause.
Explain
why.
That's because oysters grow on a shell. So a shell will, a little spat will be will spawn a new oyster onto a shell.
Explain to people what a spat is.
Baby oyster. Yeah. And it's a little tiny dot, and then it grows.
It grows into an oyster. So you have to have something for the little baby oyster to attach to, and they like to attach to other oyster shells. So these oyster reefs then grow as these shells keep attaching to each other and growing. They create these huge reefs, and the reefs also help protect us as a barrier to storms. Mm-hmm. In Hurricane Sandy, which in the film, a lot of that damage, if we had had reefs there, would have sort of absorbed the impact of the storm.
And one of the other things, when you're making a film, a 40-minute film in this case, you can only pack so much into it. But one of the things that the Billion Oyster Project does that I think you see in the film is obviously they're connecting with kids who are at the Harbor School and also kids at public schools throughout the city. So there are little mini reefs and or oyster cages growing all over the city that public school students are setting up, managing, monitoring, and really contributing to this. It's funny, this morning I was thinking about the title of the film, which is always the last and hardest thing to come by. And I was so happy about it because I realized these kids really are taking back the harbor, and that includes public school students all over the city.
Were these reefs in existence before, and they were just destroyed by pollution or time or overfishing? What happened to the original reefs?
Well, so New York City was the oyster capital of the world. And oysters were so plentiful in New York that there were oyster carts on the corners the way there are hot dog carts on corners now. And so, they had oysters the size of plates. Wow. That's how big the oysters were in the harbor. So people lived on oysters, but they ate all the oysters. Believe it or not, they ate them, and that combined with pollution
and dredging
for ships, destroyed all the reefs. So it was a combination of sort of in the late 1800s, eating all the oysters,
overfishing and over,
and then so it was overfishing, and also dredging.
Mm-hmm. We're talking to Christy Jacobson and Roger Ross Williams about their film, Take Back the Harbor. So these kids that are at the Harbor School, what's the curriculum like? How do you learn to do this? What do you have to learn to be able to do this?
Okay, so it's really cool. So it's first of all, the school is on the Governor's Island, and there's a high school, and it looks like a classic high school. There's hallways and classrooms and all the rest. And then there's also the maritime building. And in there is where you literally see a hatchery. So a hatchery is where oysters grow. And there's all kinds of, you know, tanks of various kinds of little underwater living creatures and kind of platters where you see the oysters and they're, what are they doing when they're making spat, when they're procreating? I forget the word.
They're doing that.
They're making little baby oysters.
Doing the do.
The kids at the school are studying also. They're learning to drive boats, and they're diving and learning to dive. And
how to fix boats.
Yeah, and there's a girl in our film who, Chris Maris, who could not swim. And
that's a common thing with city kids, too. Especially from urban environments. Yeah. They don't know how to swim.
And here she is. She not only got over her fear of swimming, but she's diving now and building oyster reefs. And that's it's amazing to watch her conquer that.
So how it works is, in addition to the regular traditional curriculum, they are getting 1 to 2 or 3 hours a day, many hours a week in these very specific areas. So it's vessel operations, scuba diving, the aquaculture, marine biology. And so they're learning these skills in kind of classroom, but more often in the real world.
And they go off to college and become marine biologists and become vessel operators. So it's they're sort of training these kids in sort of maritime. And again, kids from the city, you don't think of them as, you know, marine biologists. You don't see black and brown kids as marine biologists. And these kids are like passionate about marine biology.
Now, I think for people who live in New York a long time, you think about the river keepers. How are the river keepers involved in this project?
Yeah. So, well, Murray Fisher, who is one of the founders of the Billy and Oyster Project, was a river keeper. So he came up in that environment and with that ethos. And I think something that we learned in the making of the film is that, you know, the thing that was really important for River Keeper, that's also important for the Billy and Oyster Project, is it's important to have access to the water. It's important to be able to capture or catch your own fish, and it's important that you are able to then eat that, which we're pretty far from right now, but we're, you know, this project is bringing us closer to, meaning it needs to be clean and safe and not toxic. But I think that access piece is key, as Roger was saying, that, you know, many kids.
New York City has sort of hard borders. You can't really access the water. And one of the goals of, you know, of these, the Harbor School and these kids are to create these sort of soft borders. I mean, it used to be, you know, vegetation, and you can walk up to the water, and you can't even get to the water now.
And there's a whole process of permitting. It's not like they just let these kids and all these organizations like, hey, just throw your shells in there and good luck with that.
Yeah, no, it's an enormous task. And, it's both an enormous task for the Billy and Oyster Project and for the filmmakers trying to capture it. Because, A, there is, the EPA and the DEP are concerned with keeping bad things out of the water, obviously. So they're not used to people trying to put good things, i.e. oysters, that filter. They're not really set up that way. So they need to go through a ton of hoops in order to get the permits that they need. And then on top of it, because of the CSOs that we described, if it rains more than a quarter inch for the next 3 days, it's not safe for anything to be happening in the water, for kids to be in the water, whether that's just putting, you know, cages in off the shore or diving. And so for them, scheduling, you know, around the kids' school schedule, and then you have, you know, hundreds of days when you can't actually do the work. So they are really committed. And, you know, in mentioning the river keepers, I mean, something that's really great is, like Roger was saying, these kids are going on to do this work both in their college and or career paths, but they're just committed. You know, they're like fully just believers in the role that they can play, and they feel really connected to the earth and to the planet in ways that is clearly not common in our generation. We're just apparently throwing stuff out our windows.
Are they close to a billion oysters?
Ooh.
Are we allowed to say?
Do you have the number? Do you have it?
No, I don't.
Oh, I think it's 28 million. Pete and Murray are probably listening, and if I'm getting it wrong, I'm worried about
You can
about
tweet
this.
At us.
Okay.
Tweet us the correct number,
but yeah,
Pete and Murray.
They are every year, the most important thing is every year, more oysters are not only being planted, but importantly, thriving in New York's harbor. And that's the really important message, I think, that should be taken from this, is in the harbor that you see, that you think is disgusting, actually oysters are thriving, and they're absolutely going to make their goal of a billion.
And so are the kids at the school. They're thriving as well.
They are thriving as well, absolutely.
Take Back the Harbor airs on Discovery Channel on Tuesday, December 18th at 8 p.m. Christy and Roger, thanks for joining us on All of It.
Thank you.
Thank you.
We'll be back after a quick break with another week of classical music selections and the stories behind them with our colleague at WNYC, Clemency Burton Hill. This is All of It. Welcome back to All of It on WNYC. I'm Allison Stewart, and joining me now in studio is Clemency Burton Hill, WNYC's Creative Director for Music and Arts. Her new book, Year of Wonder, Classical Music to Enjoy Day by Day, is a collection of songs and compositions, one for every day of the year, with an accompanying anecdote or backstory for each piece. Clemmy stops by All of It every Monday to tell us about a couple of pieces we can expect to find in the book for the week, and also to edumacate us, play us some music. We're talking Tchaikovsky? And Vivaldi this week?
Yep. Well, sort of Vivaldi.
All right. Vivaldi-esque. Vivaldi adjacent. Let's start for this first week of December. You're starting with Tchaikovsky.
I am indeed. And he's quite a famous guy, I suppose, particularly right now. People might be thinking about Tchaikovsky. None of us can say it this morning. because he wrote The Nutcracker, mm-hmm. which is probably the most famous ballet. And if you're here in New York, it's already at Nutcracker season up at Lincoln Center and many other places as well. But what's interesting to me and what I really wanted to do in this book is populate it with real human beings. Mm-hmm. We've talked about this over the past few weeks, and Tchaikovsky is such an interesting one. He wrote some of the most beautiful and radiant music that is out there, and yet he himself was such a tortured soul. He was almost certainly gay, but of course could not admit that out loud. And actually, his brother was also a homosexual, and he once wrote to his brother that our dispositions are the greatest and most insuperable obstacle to happiness, and we must fight our natures to the best of our ability, which really breaks my
That's
heart.
That's heartbreaking.
But, I mean, you know, the history of homosexuality littered with people who felt like they had to do the same thing. So he actually got married at the age of 37 to a former student who'd been showering him with fan mail. And, of course, it was a sham. And, of course, it was a disaster. And it really caused in him this bout of crippling writer's block. He suffered from cycles of what he described as wearying and maddening depression. And I've chosen a piece of music that you would never know that if you heard it, because it's so unbelievably beautiful and it has this lightness of touch. But so he had this period of writer's block, and he went to Switzerland to try and put himself back together after the demise of this catastrophe of a marriage. And at first things did not go well. He was struggling to compose a new piano sonata, I think was what he was trying to write. He wrote back to his brother, you know, I'm working unsuccessfully, I'm not getting any progress, I'm having to force myself to work without much enthusiasm, having to squeeze out of myself weak and feeble ideas and ruminate over each bar, but I keep at it and I hope that inspiration will suddenly strike. And boy, did inspiration strike. He was visited by a former student, another former student, this time a male one, called Josef Kotek. And historians believe that the two were almost certainly lovers, but certainly Kotek was a form of muse for Tchaikovsky. He was incredibly inspiring to him. And Tchaikovsky ends up writing this violin concerto in D major, which is one of the gleaming monuments of violin concertos in the repertoire. I think we should have a little listen. Thank you. hope that's beating the Monday blues.
I have this very deep connection to Tchaikovsky. When I was in college, I think it was my sophomore year, I took a music course and I had to write a paper about him. And I worked at the college radio station. And I remember staying there over Thanksgiving to finish his paper. And this is how old it was. I spliced together audio tracks on tape to go with my paper to hand it, my first multimedia paper. and I just had to finish it. I couldn't go home without finishing it. So
wow.
That's my Tchaikovsky story.
That's amazing. And I put it in the book for the 4th of December, which is tomorrow. That was the date in 1881 when the premiere took place. And unfortunately, Tchaikovsky was going to dedicate it to Kotek because, as he said, how lovingly he busies himself with my concerto. I would never have been able to do anything without him, is what he said. And then he thought that this would engender gossip, so he didn't dedicate it to Kotek. And then Kotek never forgave him for that.
Our next piece, not Vivaldi.
Not Vivaldi.
A contemporary composer.
Our next piece is actually by Eric Whitaker, who is an American composer born in 1970. Very, very cool guy. He's incredibly personable, and he's a fantastic communicator about classical music. And goodness knows, classical music needs some good communicators. he's a wonderful example of how contemporary composers and musicians are really redefining what can be a very ancient form. I've chosen a piece which I hope we're not too early for something that feels at least a little bit festive. This is, it's pretty much a carol, though you could interpret it any way you want. It's called Lux Aurumque. And I should say that Eric Whitaker is so fabulously prolific, and he doesn't just write wonderful music, but he's addressed the UN Speakers Programme and the World Economic Forum in Davos. He's appeared at the iTunes Festival. He's given two main stage TED Talks, and that was based on the idea that he created something called a virtual choir. There you are talking about being a pioneer at your radio station, splicing together tape. You know, in your multimedia former life, splicing together tape. He was someone who's really jumped on the possibilities of what these digital revolutions of our last few years could really mean for classical music. And he created this virtual choir, which brings together singers from about 110 countries from all over the globe in a digital performance.
I know who he is.
Work.
Yeah. I think I saw this TED Talk.
You probably did.
In real time.
Yeah.
Oh my gosh.
I was about to say, he kind of looks like he's a very handsome, like he could be a movie star.
Yeah.
He's a very handsome guy, very personable, very, very collegial.
Yeah, he was born after Kennedy was president. Let's put it that way.
He's born in 1970. He's a veritable spring chicken. So let's have a listen to this. It's Lux Aurumque.
I know exactly who this is. Okay, go.
Light and Gold.
Sung in Latin.
Well, interesting. You'd think that maybe he was setting some ancient Latin text. Actually, this is a contemporary poem written in English by Edward Esch, who's a contemporary of Whitaker's. And Whitaker says that the genuine and elegant simplicity that he found in a poem, Light and Gold, really appealed to him in terms of setting it to music. But he felt that somehow it would work better setting in Latin. And actually, when you're writing for voices, there's something about the Latin vowels and the way that the mouth works over Latin words that lends itself beautifully to singing. I'm intrigued by that. I'm sort of nerdy about music and language and why this and why do composers set in certain languages. And Latin, it turns out, is a very works very well with the human voice. But I love that. And you can have a look on YouTube. I think it's been viewed something like 5 million times since they uploaded it. But what a fantastic message that actually music can be this universal language, that you can get people from more than 110 countries around the globe singing the same thing.
And our final piece.
This is by a very cool lady called Gabriela Montero, also a contemporary composer, also born in 1970. This one is for the weekend, 9th of December. This is her riffing on one of the most famous pieces of classical music in the canon, which, you know, even if you only have a very passing acquaintance with classical music, you've probably heard something in your life, the Four Seasons by Antonio Vivaldi. And she is a wonderful improviser. So she, which very many classical musicians wouldn't feel comfortable with, she can really sit there and just improvise on stage. I've seen it live and it is breathtaking to behold. So this is her take on Vivaldi's Winter from the Four Seasons. Venezuela, and what I love about the way she improvises is you couldn't necessarily hear it in that clip. I wanted to make sure that you could hear some of the original Vivaldi in there, but if you listen to the whole piece, you know, she brings in tango and Latin American flavors, she brings in the blues, impressionism, and she's just got all of this in her own musical imagination. She's really magical.
Can you give us a little tease about next week?
Well, we are heading into the festive season, so I have a beautiful Christmas-themed Baroque concerto by a true master of the form, a 20th century carol by a British woman who may or may not have been a secret agent during the Second World War, and also one of the most ravishing ever settings of the Ave Maria. I promise it's guaranteed to assuage whatever holiday craziness might be heading your way.
Clemmy, thank you so much. We'll see you next Monday.
See ya. Thanks.
All of It will be back after a quick break. You're listening to All of It on WNYC. I'm Allison Stewart. We're going to spend the next few minutes discussing exorcisms. Now, there are many things that go through your mind when you decide to do a segment about exorcisms. Do you lean into the cultural stereotype and play the iconic clip from the movie? Probably not. Do you open the lines to calls? Maybe not a good idea. Do you offer a disclaimer that the segment you're about to hear deals with some sensitive cultural and religious practices and that the segment aims to be informative and not at all judgmental? Yes, yes, you do. Joining us now is the author of a piece in the latest issue of The Atlantic titled American Exorcism. It argues the ancient Catholic ritual of exorcism is potentially more popular now than ever. The article has gotten a lot of attention, and we're pleased to welcome its author, Mike Mariani, to All of It. Hi, Mike.
Hi, thanks a lot for having me.
All right, let's get some definitions down so people understand what we're talking about. To be someone who is in need of an exorcism, what has happened to you?
Well, it depends. I mean, from the point of view of the Catholic Church, you have to undergo what's called a discernment process. A discernment process is a 7-step protocol that they put these individuals through who have requested a Catholic exorcism. Did you want me to go over a couple of those steps, or?
Well, I'm curious about what kind of symptoms, is that the right word, does a person necessarily have had exhibited to think that they might need an exorcism?
Right, right. So I think there's a little bit of a gap in terms of what people experience that causes them to believe that they are possessed. I mean, I think a lot of that could be what you might call dissociative episodes, sort of supernatural encounters, experiences that they can't themselves explain. Now, from the point of view of the Catholic Church, there are 4 classic doctrinal signs of demonic possession. I mean, these are the signs that they're always going to be looking for when someone has requested an exorcism. They are the ability to speak a language that the person would have otherwise have no way of knowing, that they had never learned. Preternatural or excessive strength. So, you know, you could imagine maybe a young girl overpowering two or three grown men, something like that. Secret or esoteric knowledge. A lot of times this manifests itself in the form of people knowing private information about others that they would have no way of knowing. I mean, when I say it manifests itself in that form, I mean in terms of the reporting that I did, the Catholic priest and the Catholic exorcist that I spoke to. And then the last one, which has kind of become a Hollywood cliche at this point, an aversion to holy objects, whether that's the crucifix, holy water, things like that.
All right. So there's two different things that people describe, a demonic oppression and a demonic possession. What's the difference between the two?
Yeah. So from the point of view of the Catholic Church and Catholic priests, demonic oppression is actually pretty widespread, pretty pervasive. It's when a demon is sort of trying to gain entry into this person and into this person's life. They may be influencing the person in kind of subtle, nuanced ways. And in general, they're moving closer to a full or complete possession. Now, demonic possession is much more of what we're familiar with kind of in pop culture and Hollywood and movies, where the demon is able to take full control of the person, to speak through them, to act through them, to control their faculties, all of those things. So there is a pretty significant difference between those two from the perspective of the church.
And from the perspective of the church, how does a priest determine whether someone is truly demonically possessed?
Right. So that's where this discernment process comes into play.
Okay.
So you can't really just say, hey, listen, I need an exorcism and schedule one, you know, 2 weeks in advance. It's actually a pretty elaborate process that individuals have to go through with the Catholic Church. A couple of the things that you have to do is you have to undergo a physical examination, a psychiatric evaluation, and those two things are so that the church can rule out any more conventional or material explanation for what's happening to you. And there's a few more steps. Those are the most important ones. And then the final hurdle is, are you showing any of those four classic signs?
Mm-hmm.
And if you are, then the Catholic exorcist for the particular diocese that you've reached out to will reach out to his bishop, and from there, you know, they can agree to actually begin performing exorcisms on that person.
So you wrote this story. Can you give us an idea of the numbers behind this rise in exorcisms? How much is the demand growing?
Yeah, so it's actually really hard to get hard figures and to get, like, strong statistics necessarily. I mean, the ways that we were able to demonstrate it and the ways the indicators that we looked to were two things. One, the amount of actual Catholic exorcists. So I think around 2010, there were around 15 Catholic exorcists in the U.S. Today, there are at least 100, according to most of the priests and exorcists that I spoke to. So from within the Catholic Church, the amount of priests that are now trained, sanctioned exorcists has went up, you know, 7-8-fold in less than a decade. That's one. The more persuasive statistic that I came across is just from the exorcists themselves saying how in recent years they have gotten more requests for exorcisms than they ever have in their careers. I know Father Vincent Lampert, an exorcist, I think, based in Illinois, said that in 2018, or up to this point in 2018, he's gotten maybe around 1,500 requests, which was, according to him, by far the most he'd ever gotten since becoming an exorcist.
So you mentioned that increase in numbers of people who can perform exorcisms. What kind of training do you have to go through?
So that I don't know quite as much about that. There are so many facets to possession and exorcism, and we couldn't cover every single one. But I know that there are schools. So there's a seminary in Chicago, I believe, or in the Chicago metropolitan area, that priests are sent to. and that's kind of like an ongoing training program where they are trained to become an exorcist. There's a few of those also in Rome. So I know in the past, like in the 90s and in the first decade in the 2000s, a lot of American priests would go to Rome to be trained as exorcists. So these seminaries, these schools, these programs exist both in the U.S. and in the Vatican and in Rome.
We're talking to journalist Mike Mariani about his article, American Exorcism, which is in the current issue of The Atlantic. You spent a good part of your article following a woman named Louisa, and you spent a lot of time with her and with her husband. Tell people who Louisa is and how you found her.
Yeah, so Louisa is a young woman in her 30s. She grew up in Washington State. She lives there now, although she spent some time in Florida. I found Louisa actually through social media. So I had a few different methods for trying to reach out to people and contact people who believed that they were possessed at one point or had undergone an exorcism. And, you know, of the dozen or so people that I actually was able to establish contact with, you know, an interview and speak to, Louisa's story to me felt like the most compelling, the most grounded, and most importantly, probably, you know, the most corroborated by other people in her life, including mental health professionals. So that's why we decided to focus in on her narrative.
So what was going on in Louisa's life? What did she experience that led her to believe that she was being demonically possessed?
Right. So there's two tracks here, right? And that's kind of what made the reporting process really interesting for me. So when I first started talking to Louisa, she recounted these nocturnal episodes that to some could be construed as sleep paralysis. I'm not sure if all listeners are familiar with that, but basically there were encounters in the middle of the night where she would feel paralyzed, completely unable to move, but she would be conscious. And these seemingly supernatural things would happen to her. At one point, she felt a hand on her shoulder blade and breathing near her ear. She also had other supernatural, hallucinatory types of experiences like this. And that was what she first shared with me. As I continued to report on her story, talk to her more, talk to people in her life, I uncovered that she was also around the same time, you know, this is pretty much throughout since maybe 2000, for the past 10 or 15 years, she was also experiencing episodes during the day where she would, you could call it dissociate, or lose consciousness, and another personality or another persona would emerge in the place of the Louisa that everyone knew. And what made this second class of experiences really kind of, I mean, compelling and chilling in a way, is that this wasn't just an alternate persona. This was something that was saying how it wanted to take possession of Louisa, to kill Louisa, that Louisa was in this person's control, that it wanted her soul. So just the things it was saying, the language it was using, really just lended itself to the idea of demonic possession.
Now, Louisa's husband, Stephen, actually showed you a video that he recorded of one of her episodes. He started to record them. Will you describe that video?
Yeah, so he recorded the video, I think it was in 2014, and this was because he'd seen these episodes before, and it reached a certain point where by the fifth or sixth or seventh episode, he just wanted some sort of documentary evidence in the event that, you know, maybe a journalist like me would come across one day. And the video, she's speaking in a really low, hushed tone. She's kind of whispering, but it's a really malevolent whisper, saying things a lot like, you know, what I just told you about how, you know, Louisa is mine. She's mine. I'm going to take her soul. Just those kinds of dark things that you would only ever see in a movie. And in addition to saying those things and speaking in this really low, hushed, kind of wicked cadence, she also, I don't know how to describe it, besides just underwent these really strange physical contortions where she would just be twisting her body. Her head and her neck would suddenly kind of fire backwards. And, you know, it looked a lot like the kinds of painful-looking gymnastics and contortions that we think of when we think of demonic possession. And I just want to quickly add that, look, these things are subject to all different interpretations, but as I mentioned in the article, this video did not in any way give me the sense that it was faked, that it was staged.
Now, as Luisa has had some trouble in her life, she has had some substance abuse issues, correct?
Yes.
And has she had mental health issues?
Yes. Yeah, so she does have a history of trauma, having to do with sexual molestation dating back to when she was young.
So now what in her life and in her family's life and people who are close to her make them believe that this behavior and these difficult situations are not the result of her trauma versus her being possessed by a demon?
Yeah, it's a great question. And I think it kind of gets to the heart of why this topic is so interesting, because, you know, there is always a psychological framework and lens that you can use. I think a couple of things. So one, her husband, and again, I mentioned this in the piece, he told me that for a significant period of time, he felt that what she was experiencing, what he was witnessing, had some sort of psychological explanation and must have been rooted in her own background, trauma, and things like that. But at a certain point, according to him, he started to see things that he felt could not be easily explained, whether that's, you know, lights turning on and off inexplicably, electronic equipment that he swore or was certain was broken or hadn't worked in years suddenly flashing on, just different really small things that he just was really shocked and disarmed by. And according to him, in some cases, these inexplicable events happened either around Luisa or around the time of her episodes. So for him, that was kind of the point at which he started to entertain other possibilities.
And we should say that Luisa was a predetermined that she was a case of a demonic oppression, and she underwent an exorcism. Do we know what happened with Luisa?
Yeah, so just to be clear, so the priest that she saw determined that it was a case of demonic oppression, but he actually did not carry out an exorcism.
Oh, I'm sorry, I misunderstood.
Yeah, no problem. So his sense, so he saw her a few times. The first time he saw her, there were, she did some things in their time together that were extremely concerning to him, including something that looked like speaking in tongues and the physical contortions. But then in subsequent meetings, she was a little calmer, and that same inexplicable behavior did not happen at the same level. So eventually he decided not to reach out to the bishop or continue the process of getting her an exorcism.
But they continued to meet, right? That's why I got confused.
Yeah. So they met a few times.
Gotcha.
And the last time I checked in, she was going to try and reach out to him again.
And one of the things I think is so interesting, we only have about a minute left, is that Catholic doctrine teaches about that there are doorways. They consider them doorways for demonic oppression, and that perhaps we're in a time in history when these doorways are more open than others. Can you explain that?
Yeah, so from the Catholic perspective, the doorways have to do with the occult. That's the biggest one. So if people are, quote, dabbling in the occult is the term that they like to use, whether that's Ouija boards, tarot cards, palm reading, fortune telling, witchcraft, spell casting, all of that stuff to them is opening the doorway for a demon to enter your life. There are multiple explanations for why there's this increasing belief in demonic possession and more people believing they are possessed, but a lot of them do touch on the occult. And the increase in interest in the occult and occult activity and participation.
The name of the piece is American Exorcism. It's in the current issue of The Atlantic. Mike Mariani, thank you so much for sharing your reporting. We appreciate it.
Thanks very much.
You've been listening to All of It on WNYC.
Since WNYC's first broadcast in 1924, we've been dedicated to creating the kind of content we know the world needs. In addition to this award-winning reporting, your sponsorship also supports inspiring storytelling and extraordinary music that is free and accessible to all. To get in touch and find out more, visit sponsorship.wnyc.org.